Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889, and by French Market Coffee, locally roasted in New Orleans for 125 years. WWNO New Orleans and our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Farmers have always been my heroes. I don't think there's harder work in the world than farming. Physical labor aside, farmers could also give professional gamblers a run for their money, because ultimately, Mother Nature and the forces of weather always hold the winning hand. This week, we're visiting some very unusual farm operations. We begin at Gourmet Mushrooms in Sonoma County, California. The Gourmet Mushroom facility is more of a science lab than a farm. Then, we visit an urban farm located in the most unusual spot, right in New Orleans' central city, almost under the Mississippi River Bridge. And we have a visit from Fernando Garcia, a Guatemalan banana farmer who shares with us the plight of a fruit we all take for granted, but is actually now in danger of extinction. We're planting the seeds for an exotic harvest on this week's Louisiana Eats. When Gourmet Mushrooms was founded in Sonoma County, California in 1977, it was a small farm selling specialty mushrooms to restaurants in the San Francisco Bay Area. Since then, the company has expanded in size and distribution, harvesting 8 different varieties of organic mushrooms for specialty food wholesalers, gourmet grocers, and restaurants all across America. As part of a 4-day seminar at the American Harvest Workshop, Louisiana Eats was invited with chefs, journalists, and other food enthusiasts to tour the Gourmet Mushroom Farm and learn about their cultivation process. Upon arriving, we were greeted by our guide, Chef Liaison Bob Engel, who began with a joke to break the ice.
So my rule is this: if I don't know the answer to a question, I will make it up. Because that's the way my dad taught me. On the other hand, if I ever say I don't know, that means I can't tell you, I'm sorry. I'd have to kill you if I told you. So I don't know means I can't tell you. And any other answer I give may or may not be true, you'll never know. Okay. So let's start the tour. We're gonna head all the way around the opposite corner of the building because I want you guys to see it in chronological order the same way that the mushrooms see it. Mind your step, this is agriculture.
When we arrived at the building, we were welcomed by a pleasant aroma coming from a ribbon blender, mixing together ingredients called substrate, the food mushrooms need to thrive.
So from this point here, you actually see both ends of the process. There we have raw materials coming in. Mostly sawdust. We're currently getting our sawdust from a lumber mill in Wisconsin. It's red oak sawdust. There are also some other things that we put in, soybean hull, wheat bran, okara for some varieties, which is the spent material from making tofu. The process is entirely organic. There's no pesticides used. There's no artificial fertilizers of any sort. So at this point here, we've got raw materials coming in. This is a batch of materials being mixed up for the morning's run. At that end there, you can see all of those bottles. The mushrooms have been harvested from those bottles, and we're going to take that substrate out of there, goes into the dump truck, goes to a company that makes soil amendments. Everything that comes out of the farm goes back to the soil. We're gonna go around the corner now and let's see what they're doing.
Around the corner, we watched as a machine packed the prepared substrate into groups of small plastic bottles as they moved down a conveyor belt.
People have been growing mushrooms on wood for thousands of years, and the original system was to drill a hole in a log, fill it with mycelium, and wait for that log to give the mushroom enough food that it will push up the part we want to eat. Somebody in the 50s in Japan started experimenting with using sawdust instead of a wood log. We're pre-chewing the food for the mushroom. Mushrooms that would take a year to start on a solid log, we can grow here in 7.5 weeks. Because the mushroom gets to envelop each grain of sawdust and just chomp up the food and do what it wants to do. We're not growing from seeds. Mushrooms don't have seeds. We're not growing from spores. We could, but it's a little more complicated than we need to be. We're growing mushrooms from mushroom. We're going to take this sawdust substrate and we're going to sterilize it. That's a pressure cooker. 14 pounds of pressure, 240 degrees of temperature. All of our substrate is sterilized. So this machine here takes that sawdust from the ribbon blender that we started at, puts it into bottles one at a time. Using a plastic bottle, we can use the bottle over and over and over again, and even at the end of its cycle, when it starts to degrade or crack or something, we can still recycle it because it's not all that hard to clean. We also put a little Dibbit stick down the center of each jar so that when we add the starter, the inoculant, that little bit of mycelium that we're going to start things from, instead of just growing from the top down, some of it drops down the middle and it grows from the inside out. Much more efficient that way. It's as if we're cloning, but we're only doing what Mother Nature does in the forest. You've heard that the largest organism on the planet is a mushroom. It's mushroom mycelium that runs through the forest floor so that if you start here and pick up DNA and walk a half mile that way and pick up DNA, you get the same mushroom. Each one of these bottles becomes a core of forest floor. We myceliate it with a little bit of the thread of the mycelium that we've kept either in a super cold, like minus 70 degree freezer, that's where we keep our library so we never lose track of these strains, or just on an agar-agar plate where we can pull a little bit off to start some spawn to start the next batch. So at this site here, we're bringing in raw materials. This door has a twin on the other side of the wall. The sterilizer goes all the way through the wall. So we load it up with these bottles, sterilize them, open it at the other end, let them cool down there. That's the cleanest area of the farm. Visitors never go there. So before we go through the second set of double doors, there's some foot baths, if you would please. You just need to get the bottoms of your feet wet. Any one of those baths will do.
In addition to the foot baths, everyone in our group was asked to put on hair nets to limit potential contamination. We all admittedly looked pretty silly, but before we had a chance to get self-conscious, we found ourselves at the germination room.
There are over 500,000 bottles here. We hand harvest 65,000 bottles a week. It gives us about 22,000 pounds of mushrooms every week, 52 weeks a year. This bottle is a really good representation of what we're doing. If you see these bottles over here, they're almost entirely brown. That's the sawdust. Those bottles behind you, almost entirely white, that's the mycelium. This bottle here is partway through that process. You see the brown sawdust at the bottom, and you see the white mycelium at the top. You also see a little bit of mycelium at the bottom, where that hole allowed the culture to start growing more rapidly. That stuff there, this stuff here, this white fuzzy stuff, that is the mushroom. The thing that we eat is not a mushroom. The thing that we eat is the fruit of the mushroom. It is the apple, not the apple tree. This is the apple tree. When you pluck a mushroom in the forest, you're only taking the reproductive apparatus, the fruit body. It's there with its stem to get the cap up into the airflow, and its gills to send spores out into the world, Once that is over, its job is done, and it starts to degrade. In this room here, all of these bottles can share springtime temperatures together, and all of our varieties can have pretty much the same kind of spring. But in order to get this mycelia to pop up with the mushroom that we want to eat, we have to do the same thing to them that Mother Nature does. We drop the temperature and raise the humidity. The mushroom thinks it's fall, and it's time to get busy. So we're going to go on now into the fall area.
In the next room, the bottles of mycelium move down a conveyor belt where they were turned upside down, and the contents at the tops of each bottle were scraped off.
So this machine here does a process called quincaque. In cuisine, we steal words from the French that we can't say in English. Sauté, roux. In the mushroom industry, we steal words from the Japanese, because there's no word for quincaque in English. What it's doing is it's scraping off the top about half inch. It's the driest spot, and it's the hardest spot. It's been exposed longest to the air. If there's any little contamination that's gotten in, it might be right there. So by scraping that away, we make it easier for mushrooms to come through. As we go around the corner, take a look at the modest but impressive level of technology. Every room has a CO2 meter on it. Every room has humidity and temperature dialed in for the mushroom that will give the best product. At the old farm, we had to take many different varieties, and it was like roommates at college. They might not like the same music, but they had to share a room. Here, we're able to take each mushroom and give it just the conditions that can make it flourish. As we go in, we're going to sort of do a conga line. So there's a corridor, and you can go down the right-hand side and come back up the left, and that way we all fit inside.
One by one, we proceeded into the first harvest room, packed with bottles, abounding with beautiful growing mushrooms.
So the room that you're in is Trumpet Royale, also known as a king oyster. As you walked in on the side, you saw some Nebbiolo Bianco. The reason it can share this condition is that is also an oyster mushroom. So both the majority of the mushrooms, the big ones in the center, Trumpet Royale, King Oyster, Pleurotus oryngii, and the ones on the white shelf over there, those are Pleurotus nebridensis. That one grows wild in Sicily, and it likes really cold conditions. So we actually cold shock that mushroom at a certain point in its development to give it the idea that it's under snow. And then we start it up again in the spring, as it were. The disco lights that you see on the nebridensis over there, that's a little experiment to see if they respond better to more light, if they respond better to white light or blue light. One of the great things about growing mushrooms this way with the very short growth cycle is that we learn quickly. We're data heavy. So if we get an idea about how to improve a mushroom, we can test it in 8 weeks. We can verify it in 16 weeks. We can see if we can scale it up in 24 weeks. And within a year, we've got a better mushroom on the shelf. If you were growing on logs with a one-year cycle, it would take you 3 or 4 years to learn that much information. So I appreciate you folks coming. I love showing this place off because I remember what it felt like when I first walked inside. And it's a really weird, strange, wonderful farm. Thank you.
Bob Engel, chef liaison at Gourmet Mushrooms. When we return from a short break, we're visiting an urban farm located almost underneath the Crescent City Connection. Wait till you hear about the exotic things they've got growing. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Rouse's Markets and from Cafe B, featuring contemporary Creole cuisine with an emphasis on fresh Gulf seafood, served in a classic old Metairie setting. Lunch, dinner, Sunday brunch, and private events on Metairie Road.
My name is Jordan Banthwell, and I'm the co-owner of Southbound Gardens. We're an urban farming company that does many things, most notably our nursery, but we're also urban chicken farmers.
3 years ago, in the shadow of US 90 and the Crescent City Connection, on a keyhole lot almost invisible from the street, Jordan Banthwell and his partner Ian Wilson started Southbound Gardens, an urban farm in the heart of New Orleans' Central City.
It's kind of convenient for our purposes because it's difficult to develop. There might actually be a house here if it weren't for the inconvenient situation, having it be a keyhole lot.
Would you take us on a tour of your garden space?
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so we have several fruit trees, many of which we were lucky enough to have planted before our time. There was a legendary gardener named Philip here long before we got to the space. And there's been a series of gardeners that have come through this place since. And it's been in our hands for the past 3 years. But we've got apple trees, peach trees, papayas, we have fig trees, we have a bay laurel, which is supplying several restaurants actually with all of their bay needs. Four citrus trees, sugar cane, oh, there's another fig, a grapevine, blackberry patch, a couple bananas. That banana was planted when we got here.
And does it yield edible bananas?
It does. There's some growing that should be ripe by the fall right now. And they're unlike any banana you've ever tasted from the grocery store. It honestly tastes more like banana-flavored candy, which I always thought was such a weird flavor. I never liked it when I was growing up as a kid. I picked out the banana runts until I tried these bananas and realized that flavor actually has a real analog as far as bananas in the real world, and they're delicious, they're amazing. They're more fibrous and a lot sweeter than a regular banana. So this is shiso, also known as perilla, and shiso is a Japanese herb. It's common in sushi. This all came from one single plant. We didn't realize how aggressive it is. It, one single plant, and it spread across the entire farm after one season. All this right here is red leaf amaranth. Amaranth has been eaten for thousands of years, mostly for the grain. We do this one more as a leaf spinach, and we sell that to restaurants. Mountain spinach is one of the common names. No relation at all to spinach. Here we have the padron peppers, which is said to be kind of like a Mexican version of a shishito pepper. Supposedly more of a sweet than a hot pepper, but I beg to differ.
It looks like you've got an enviable fig tree back there.
We cut that thing way back. Figs are notorious for being cut back and then coming back stronger than ever and producing a really good crop the next year.
And what's that, a little sugar cane?
Yes, we're growing sugar cane. Another really easy to grow crop, actually. You just lay down a stick of sugar cane and it'll sprout roots and put up leaves and make new canes. So this is the white okra. This came from, I got two different varieties of okra that were growing this year, and they came from a friend who was staying at a farm in Japan. And this guy, he said, take these seeds when you go, spread them around, evenly around your bag so they don't get picked up by security, and take them to someone much like myself to propagate them. And it was funny, she actually brought him some okra, thinking, wouldn't that be fun to share one of our southern vegetables, one of our southern treats, with these Japanese farmers. But he turned around and said, let me show you our okra. And we also have a 10-pointed okra. Usually there's five ridges on an okra. He called that one Okuta Okura. And it's really beautiful, actually. Growing in and around the apple mint here, we have a Roselle hibiscus plant, also known as a cranberry hibiscus because of the kind of tangy, almost cranberry-like flavor of the leaves and the calyxes, which are kind of the outside leaves of the seed pod. And if you taste the leaf here, it's Got a wonderful flavor. It's
it's kind of citrusy.
Yeah, it's citrusy. It's got that tang. And, you know, it's a very nutritious plant, really commonly eaten in Southeast Asia. And we're happy to be sharing it here in Southern Louisiana.
Any chefs catch on with this yet?
We just started marketing it. We're probably going to be giving out some free samples to let them see what they can do with it. But, you know, it's great cooked down or raw in a salad. One thing we're trying to do here is maybe stretch people's palates a little bit and introduce plants they're maybe not necessarily used to, but that might actually grow really well in our climate and could become really suitable to our culinary culture.
So you all do a CSA year-round?
Yes, we do. We have a year-round growing season, so why not do a year-round weekly produce box? People can sign up for any number of increments starting from a month all the way up to 3 to 6 months, and you can sign up on the website, or you can just drop us a line via email, and you can come pick it up whenever we're at the farmer's market. We're usually at the Saturday Crescent City Farmer's Market downtown in the CBD, as well as the Thursday market in the American Can Company parking lot in Mid-City. We also open up the nursery on Sundays. You can come visit us there, pick up your box, and do some plant shopping.
Oh, that's great fun. And for those of you who might want to come visit you on Sunday, where do they come?
So that's 4221 South Robertson. That's uptown near Ferret and Napoleon. We open up the nursery every Sunday from 10 to 1.
Thanks so much, Jordan.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you, Poppy.
Jordan Bantwell, co-owner of Southbound Gardens. Delta Delivered began with a simple idea: to bring Shreveport food to Shreveport people. Since then, owner Rebecca Kreft has become much more than a regular at farmers markets throughout North Louisiana. She scours the markets in search of the best local produce, challenging the idea that healthy food can't be easily accessed.
My name is Rebecca Kreft, and I own Delta Delivered. We get fresh fruit and vegetables from local farmers in the Shreveport area and in central Louisiana, and we do a mixed market bag that you can order every week. And it is like a CSA, except we're getting it from more than one farmer, so the variety is much wider.
What made you decide to start this business?
Well, it was kind of a collision of a lot of things, but really I had it in my head for a while. You know, why can't we just get local food and deliver that to people or get that to people? My husband was working in commercial food distribution, and he was complaining about a truck coming from California one day. And it was late. And I said, why aren't you buying anything from the Shreveport farmers? He said, well, there's not really any. And I have to fill up a truck 2 times a week from California with stuff that we don't grow in this part of the country. So, you know, this is how we do it. We don't buy from the local farmers. And I thought, well, that's, you know, strange. It seems like that the restaurants and stuff would want local produce because it tastes better. And then I started reading about the Good Eggs of the world, and the, you know, there's an Indie Plate in Baton Rouge, and there's another one in Austin. I said, oh, well, that's what they're doing. That's interesting. And so we are kind of a mesh of what I liked about those models into what I thought would work for Shreveport.
Describe your operation. I mean, do you have a warehouse someplace? How does this go?
No, we don't have a warehouse. We get it all. I've been going to the farmer's market right now because there's not a lot available produce-wise. So I've been going to the farmer's market and getting the fruits and vegetables, and then I, you know, take it home and I put them all in little bags, and then I deliver them in my car usually.
So you're kind of a one-woman operation?
I am a one-woman operation right now. I am. Well, at first, I had help, and I was all about grow, 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 grow. And I remember early on, probably in February, when I was down in Leesville at a farmer's market, I had to kind of stalk Englewood for a while to get them to return my call and sell produce to me. And I really wanted Englewood, you know, the largest organic farm in Louisiana, and just the stuff that they had. And someone said, well, you're not going to be able to do that in Shreveport. You don't have enough farmers. And I said, well, okay, well, I'll just keep driving to Alexandria then, because you've got lots of farmers, and you've got Leesville, and you've got, you know, guys in Cottonport, and there's lots of fresh vegetables. So if I just have to drive to Alexandria every week, I will. But that actually has not been the case. It has been harder, and I think that, you know, it's going to have time. So I kind of pulled back and said, we're just going to kind of grow this more organically and not push to get to some number and just kind of see where it goes from there.
And what's the customer's reactions? Because I have had experience with people who get CSAs who, if they don't have recipes included in the CSA box, they are disgruntled because they don't know what to do with the odd-looking vegetable they find in the box.
We try to get as a good mix of very popular vegetables and then just do one or two things that people haven't seen. Last week I had Asian long beans, which, despite the fact that they look like green beans, very, very long green beans, you do not boil those. So I put a note on the bag that they came in, do not boil me, saute or, you know, stir fry. So I'm not really giving recipes, it's so much as telling people what they are. But I found that the vast majority of my customers are women who like to cook and who like to garden and who know what a lot of this stuff is and who are excited about beets and, you know, sweet potato greens and things like that. I mean, I do have a lot of new families, and sometimes they don't know what this stuff is. I remember one week I got bitter melon, and everyone was like, what is this? Like, well, it's bitter melon. So, there's a lot of room for knowledge and what is seasonal and what is appropriate for Louisiana. And I know a lot of people think of local food as, you know, everyone has a different definition, 100 miles, 200 miles, some people say 300 miles. I think it's all of Louisiana and, you know, then maybe 50 miles, 100 miles into East Texas and South Arkansas. There is a lot of deception in the local food community, which I was really, really surprised to learn. Because really and truly, I just had an idea. I mean, I wanted this, and no one was doing it, you know? And so I just said, I'm going to go find some farmers and start bringing people produce. And so there is a lot of that, and people just don't know. And they don't realize that just because they're at the farmer's market doesn't mean that everything was grown.
Yeah, they're not thinking it through.
Because people want variety. Americans have come to this unrealistic expectation that they're going to have super cheap food. They're going to have everything that they want when they want it. If you think about what it costs to do those things, I mean, someone has to plant that and take care of it and all of that stuff. And to expect these really cheap prices, you're going to get agricultural practices that if you knew what was going on, you would not agree with. But that's how you get the cheap prices. So I think there's a disconnect there. People want cheap food. They want as much variety as they possibly can, but they don't really understand what is costing for that.
So what do you see is the future for your food distribution business?
Well, I would like to be able to give the restaurants a lot more options when it comes to local food and more South Louisiana stuff. And Shreveport loves South Louisiana. And so, you know, that's something that we're working on is getting, you know, it's citrus and all of those things that grow down there that don't grow up here. They just don't. And more of just a whole grocery experience, but all of it local. No one here is making fresh pasta. No one here is making cheese. No one's here is growing mushrooms. So trying to get people to do those things is kind of what I'm focusing on. It's, hey, I think you'd be really good at making cheese. You should start doing that now.
You look like a mushroom grower.
I actually talked to someone about mushrooms today because I have a pizza place that wants mushrooms. And he said, well, what are you having a hard time finding? And he's planting a garden. And I said, I'm having a really hard time finding mushrooms. He said, well, I've been thinking about getting into mushrooms. I think you should. Please, get into mushrooms. Because we had wild chanterelles earlier in the summer. But that was the only, no one's doing mushrooms here.
What a bunch of energy it must take. So congratulations. And thanks so much for talking to me.
Thanks for having me.
Rebecca Kreft, owner of Delta Delivered. New Orleans, urban farms are popping up in the most surprising places. Situated at the edge of Central City, Paradigm Gardens is a farm that caters exclusively to chefs. Paradigm also hosts a seasonal concert series, pairing farm-to-table cuisine with live music. At one of these concerts this past season, some of the city's favorite chefs served up an impeccable menu that included a spring mix salad and goat lasagna, all sourced from the farm. As funk and soul band Smokin' Bones took the stage and guests began to arrive, producer Sarah Holtz sent us this postcard.
Y'all get adventurous. Our goats are back behind the oven grill. Feel free to say hello. And if y'all see any guinea hens running around, these are, don't be scared. They're little mascots. So, welcome. Cool. How's it going?
Going good.
Paradigm Gardens is a chef's garden, chef's farm. We partnered up with Coquette, Patois, and Mobar. Three phenomenal restaurants with three fantastic chefs, Aaron Bergau, Kristen Essig, and Mike Stolfitz. Hey, how y'all doing?
Good, how are you?
Good, good. Have y'all been here before?
Yes.
Oh, cool. Welcome back. What's the last name, please?
Crosby.
Yeah, I'm Joel Hitchcock, no hyphen, Tilton. And myself, along with Jimmy Seeley. Both of us very proud Wisconsinites, but been down here since a little before Katrina, and we're here for the long haul.
You know, we were here last fall and last year here at Paradigm and enjoyed it. I'm a gardener, so I like the concept of gardening. I like urban gardening.
That's right, absolutely. Biscuits and rabbit pate, kumquat marmalade, and satsuma marmalade.
We had a little community garden before this that we mainly just sold produce weekly at this little market in the community. It was on the edge of Central City, and it was just the two of us on two little house lots growing some stuff. But eventually we started trying to make a little money or offset our costs at the garden, because it was just all our money we were pouring into it. So we started selling some produce, and since I was working at Patois, I would just bike to work and bring the produce and sell it to Aaron. So he's been buying it from that beginning.
And Aaron Bergau was like the linchpin and the first leg of the tripod with Coquette and Mobar that really got us.
We gotta shout out Aaron from Patois. I'll call him or we'll text him and be like, hey, we got this and this and this. Sometimes he'll just respond and say all of it, and we'll bring all of it and he'll take it.
We first came to him because we knew him from a business relationship, but also as friends. We played on the same soccer team. We asked him, hey Aaron, who are some chefs that you'd like to work with and that you think would be good to bring on for the garden with Paradigm Gardens? And almost immediately he mentioned Mike Stolfitz from Coquette. And then we brought Mike in, and after talking with him, we brought Kristen Essig on board from Mobar, and she's been great as well. So we couldn't ask for three better chefs. They also are super laid back in the creation of the menu. And also they kind of ask us, hey, what do you have extras of? So for example, today we brought 45 pounds of kaelet and broccoli greens to Hi Hat in a massive food grade size garbage bag. Yeah, which was an interesting sight. But so anyways, yeah, they use a lot of different produce. They respect the produce and do fantastic things with it, which is great because Jim and I will go home and cook the same stir fry every night. And so it's cool watching them transform it into, you know, delicious food. It's literally harvest, rinse, wash, clean, and deliver. So depending on which restaurant, but it can be there in as soon as 30 minutes after being harvested. So we had this music business that was really fun but not making money. And we had this community garden that was really fun and not making money. And so we figured two negatives make a positive. Put them together, you know? Pretty much we both really enjoy being outside, working with our hands, working together, and so growing produce is great, but obviously, especially in such a small plot, it's not economically feasible. And Jim knows from experience, he grew up on a farm, which you can tell you more about. But so we knew that that wouldn't alone be sustainable. So we wanted to incorporate different revenue streams. And we figured in a city like New Orleans, you got to have music, you got to have food. And so we kind of put it all together.
I think that was the thing. People were like, oh, that sounds kind of interesting, but I don't know. But once they come out here, then they're like, oh, this is where I want to be.
And tonight you're sold out.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've actually sold out, and we actually expanded the seating a bit. So we had to take some beds out of production to do so, but luckily we actually have two other lots where we grow just produce and we don't host events. And so there are secret gardens. One is off Chapatula's, and the other one is off Barone. So if any of you listeners out there are feeling adventurous, you can kind of hunt those out. But so in those ones we have, we raise squab, chicken, we have a greenhouse, we grow produce, and we just got 100 baby chicks, and we'll be raising them for eggs. But those are not at Paradigm Garden itself. So this is more of the, during the day we work hard, get our hands dirty and grow produce, and at night we wear slacks and have a good time with some good music and food.
Please to skin.
An evening at the Paradigm Gardens concert series. Where did bananas originate, and why are they so popular today? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come right back. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, and from French Market Coffee. French Market Coffee's premium blend beans are locally roasted in small batches, creating a coffee that can only be called New Orleans Bold. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. Where did bananas originate, and why are they so popular today? Bananas originally were native to Southeast Asia, mainly India. They were brought west by Arab conquerors in 327 BC, moved from Asia Minor to Africa, and finally carried to the New World by the first explorers and missionaries to the Caribbean. The first bananas arrived at the port of New Orleans from Honduras in 1899, imported by Sicilian immigrant brothers Joseph, Luca, and Felix Vaccaro, founders of the Standard Fruit Company. Eventually, Standard Fruit became the Dole Fruit Company, today's banana king. I'm Poppy Tooker, and South American bananas make for some good Louisiana eats.
My name is Fernando Garcia. I'm from Guatemala. We have a couple of banana farms down there. They're called Agricola San Jose, and the other one is called El Roble. We've been doing that for 20 years now.
By total coincidence, while making bananas foster in a cooking class, I discovered that one of my students that day was Guatemalan banana farmer Fernando Garcia. Fernando owns and operates two banana plantations in a country that is hugely impacted by the banana industry, both economically and culturally. Once we discovered our common love for bananas, I couldn't wait for the class to be over so that I could sit down with Fernando and hear all about his life in Guatemala and the current challenges facing banana farmers there. Fernando, describe for us where exactly in Guatemala your plantations are located?
About 80% of the bananas that are grown in Guatemala are grown in the south coast. There's a line of volcanoes that go through the country and divides the country in half, the Atlantic Ocean and the Pacific Ocean. We are on the Pacific Ocean. Bananas grow very nice somewhere from 0 to 100 meters over sea level. They like hot, humid weather, good soils, and they need a lot of water to grow. We are the number one producer in Central America, number two producer in Latin America. Only Ecuador, it's bigger than us. Then goes Guatemala and then Costa Rica.
So tell us a little bit about your point of view on the relationship between the banana, the Guatemalan banana, and the United States.
Bananas for Guatemala and for a lot of countries in Latin America, it's extremely important. For Guatemala, it is the second most important income crop, and Guatemala is mostly an agricultural country. The country, because of the bananas, we hire about 100,000 guys.
Wow.
So economically, it's extremely important for our country.
Fernando, how many generations has your family been doing this business?
We've been in agriculture. I'm the third generation. In bananas, I'm the first generation. Now my son is taking over. He's doing the hard work so I can go on vacations.
What is a day in the life of a worker on a banana farm like in Guatemala?
It's a lot of hard work. We sell 95% of the bananas are sold in the U.S. And the U.S. Consumers are very strict. So we have to be extremely careful with everything we do. There are 14 different jobs that need to be done during the growing of the banana bunch.
Is there much organic banana production in Guatemala?
Not in Guatemala.
Yes, people ask us about that here in Louisiana, and it's in our climates, it's just quite a challenge to grow organically, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It's too warm. We have too many diseases, too many bugs. too many bugs, too many of everything. That's why we have great quality, but we need to use chemicals. In order to have organic bananas, you need a very specific area with no influence of anything, maybe surrounded by mountains. Yeah. And
it sounds like it must be very difficult to profitably grow bananas it's that labor intensive. And yet, in the United States, I know that people regard bananas as being a very small, insignificant expense.
Yes, it's a hard thing to grow. But it's great also because we use a lot of labor. So we bring jobs to a lot of people. Mm-hmm. As an industry, we have a social program. So we get involved with the families and we get involved with a lot of things other than the job itself. So it's very rewarding too.
So there are huge challenges ahead that are facing the banana industry. Tell us about those.
Yeah. The most important one is that fusarium. Fusarium is not a new disease. It's mm-hmm. been around for, I don't know, maybe since always. They used to grow one specific line of bananas, genetically identical bananas, and they were called Gros Michel. And they were genetically engineered to be all of them just the same, so that it doesn't matter where you go, where you eat a banana, it is always the same flavor, same everything. In the 60s, Fusarium developed, changed, and started affecting all the Gros Michel bananas. And in fact, it got rid of all the bananas in the world. And bananas almost disappeared.
So how did the industry recover from that?
Thank God for guys in universities, and they were doing their job and developing new varieties of bananas, which is very hard to do because a banana is not a fruit. In order to plant, to reproduce bananas, you have to plant another plant. They developed a new line that is called Cavendish. All the world now has Cavendish line of bananas. There are some variations of the Cavendish, but they're all genetically the same thing.
So now, almost 50 years later, there's yet another problem coming for the Cavendish.
Yeah, and it's the same disease. They used to call it, and they are calling it again the same name. It's the Panama disease. So far, the world already lost 18,000 hectares of bananas.
Oh, my goodness.
And that's in the last 4 years.
What do you see for the future of the banana industry?
We are all very concerned and doing whatever the scientists need to help us find a new variety. For Guatemala, it's very important. For us as a family, it's very important. We're very happy with the way things are going for the country, because we were exporting a lot of kids to the U.S. Mm-hmm. because there were no jobs in Guatemala. And now they're staying and working. So it is nice. It's a lot of work, but it is nice.
It's a rewarding job.
Yeah, very rewarding.
When you come to America and you see bananas everywhere, you know, you're at the breakfast buffet, there's the bananas.
I get happy.
I was wondering how it makes you feel.
Yeah, I always check on the stickers uh-huh. where it comes from.
So what's your favorite way to eat bananas?
There are so many ways. I love banana fosters.
Thank you.
We have good rum down there, and we enjoy doing them. I also love the banana bread pudding.
Well, that's so interesting because, you know, we make it here. How do you all do that at home?
I made it here.
Found banana bread pudding here in New
here
Orleans.
Here in New Orleans, yeah.
Well, I'm so glad that our paths crossed. And thank you for bringing the story of the banana and all of those interesting Guatemalan flavors alive to us. So thank you, Fernando. Please don't ever come back to New Orleans again without calling us.
Of course I will. I love New Orleans. I've been visiting New Orleans for, I don't know, 30, 40 years now. And I keep coming back.
Fernando Garcia, owner and operator of banana plantations in Guatemala. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Tune in next week when we speak with Chef John Currents about his ultimate hangover cure.
So the pylon, which is the name of a Faulkner novel, also meant to suggest that you were just piling on ingredients. On the menu, we don't even describe it. I think it just says a hangover's worst enemy.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, French Market Coffee, and Rouse's Markets. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau, and with support from Dickie Brennan's Bourbon House, from oysters to redfish, serving fresh Gulf seafood on Bourbon Street. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Sarah Holtz, and Reggie Morris. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.